I'll get on with the second question. Now we're much closer to the event, in inverted commas. Do you have a view on Terence McKenna and his interesting Time Wave Zero research? End of question.
Oh, I love Terence McKenna. I've got an entire set of interviews from one of the radio guys I have done interviews with myself, and he did a whole series of interviews, many of which were not ever published as far as I know, and he's in the process of bringing them out. McKenna's work is seminal. It is beyond anything that Einstein ever could have come up with. It steps us out of the single state of consciousness. In my youth, when my body was at that particular time, I also experimented with the psychotropic substances in some significant level. And while I didn't go to the Amazon to do it, I've had those same kind of experiences that Terence McKenna had, and never thought to ever connect the I Ching to a timeline as a result.
It's awesome.
So he was able. It's truly fantastic. Mm-hmm. I tend not to look at his work while I'm doing interpretation because I don't want to be front-loading my own view of things. But his work, I believe, is accurate. I believe it has been seriously mischaracterized. Mm. His insight that he came back with from these journeys to the other dimension is on the order of a Volkswagen van, a Vanagon, okay? And when I've gone, I've been able to bring back the Volkswagen bug and maybe a couple of dune buggies that have been altered from that bug, but never quite to level of insight that he had. Nonetheless, though, his process is extremely valid, and the suffering that he and his brother went through to bring this back to us has never been lionized the way it should. End of statement.
The third question. Do you and the bots have any leads on the indigenous tribes, for example, the Maya, the Hopi, Don Alejandro, John Volo, Melchizedek, who appears to be, you know, who is representing what they say, the famous calendar, and the Mayan revelations? End of question.
We do, and it's gained in over the past 4 or 5 years, but I have a tendency to look at the stuff that I first discovered in 97 and 98 as being more pure before the whole 2012 issue started hitting mainstream and the mainstream debunkers and analysis that one might find on TV. So, I have a lot of that that actually came out in 97 and 98 in a database that I preserved because it was just so unusual and interesting. And I was aware even then of the Mayan calendar, although I didn't particularly give it much credence because the end date was so far away, I never really thought about it that much. But in 97 or 98, I kept getting this series of archetypes that I at one point labeled The Return with the article The in capitals because it appeared as though it was describing a returning condition or a revisiting as opposed to something entirely new, if that makes sense. And it was at that point that I started thinking, oh, maybe this was discussing the Planet X kind of thing. 2 or 3 years later, when the Planet X stuff started taking a big jump into the internet, I thought, well, perhaps this 97 warning or data coming out was about that. However, now I'm quite sure that it's talking about that I probably shouldn't have labeled it as the return, but rather as the capture or the seizure or the melding or something along those lines. It's not a negative, but rather the word set I would use now is a joining. And the condition has been, we've been there before, but we've never bonded to it, if you can say it that way. Whatever it is, the data that we have now seems to suggest all the way back from 97, seems to point to a period of time that we'll go through that no other level of, if we survive it and come out and do well, so to speak, humanity will not have to go through this test again. In other words, what I think is actually occurring is not merely the cyclical returning to certain areas in space or the cyclical unwinding of certain conditions, but rather actually represents humanity at the bottom of a step. And if we are able to take that step, knowingly, eyes open, as sovereign individuals facing it all, and if we take that step, then we're off on an entirely different adventure. If we're not able to take that step, then universe will provide humanity trials, tribulations to grow, and will eventually get us back to where we face the bottom of that step again. And one way to look at it could be that we are at civilization level 0, 0, and we're about to take, we have the opportunity to take the step and become a level one civilization, which would be pan-solar system and reaching out into the galaxy and beyond. So at a material level, I think that is the one of the ways in which it's going to manifest, that we are at the bottom of that step, and it's up to us to actually lift our feet and get up there. If enough of us can see the step, then we can do so. Make sense? End of statement.
That makes a lot of sense. That's a fantastically eloquent answer. Thank you very much for that. Now, one last one, a little bit more mathematical. I'm hoping you'll be able to shed some light on this. I'm no mathematician, or I'm a musician, that's similar. We currently work in base 10 mathematics, as far as I understand it. And I've heard that we might be better off working in base 12. Can you talk about this and the implications of this for pi, which is something I only grasp the understanding, but I do understand it. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. As a programmer, I actually don't work that often in base base 10. Usually, I'm working mathematically in hexadecimal at a base 16, or in ASCII, which is fundamentally a base 60 code. And as I translate words, and that's been shifted up to 256 characters with Unicode. So there is a whole lot of knowledge that comes through by not restricting yourself to base 10. However, I think that the differences are interesting and enlightening as you go through them, but an even greater level of mathematical understanding comes out of actually merging mathematics with music theory and going into string thought. And in that level of thought, one no longer attempts to reconcile the irrational numbers down to an approximation in a base 10. So in other words, who really cares what the numeric value of the irrational number of the square root of 5 might be? It is much more important and enlightening to be able to just use it as the square root of 5 and deal with the irrational number set, understanding them to be much more powerful and a bigger tool than one finds in rational numbers. End of statement. Make sense?
Very, very well said. Thank you so much. Okay, this is Michael again, and I'm now resuming a new line of inquiries from other friends that had posted questions ahead of time in our little zone forum network, and then new other additional lines of questions, if you're ready. So this first one seems a little bit off message at first, but it's really not, and it comes from a friend who's actually here with us. That's Ross. That's this quote that we had by James from the Wingmakers. So I read just a quick intro, which is that the desire for more information and knowledge is a very powerful addiction of the human mind system. And then James of Wingmakers says, quote, "I would advise that you turn your attention from the acquisition of information and knowledge and apportion it to the application of the heart virtues to yourself and all others within your local multiverse, and then simply listen to your breath, and each time you turn your attention to your breath, lean a little closer to the being inside you in the centermost point of your existence," end quote, and so on. And so this leads to a line of thought that just today I myself posted by Krishnamurti, who said we're really accumulators of knowledge, and by accumulating books, knowledge of books, quoting them, etc., we don't really go that far. So I just made this quick intro because now I'm going to go on to a new line of issues that are very mundane, and we just want to do this anyway as a discussion, as a conversation, maybe less than question and answer, simply because it is relevant to some of us here in this room, and I know for sure it's relevant to clients of mine, friends, others out there in the world. And these topics are just as mundane as economy and earth changes. So the first one question is from Johnny here with us. What does your data suggest, or what is your personal take on the economic collapse in Scandinavia and Sweden in particular? Also, since the Baltic is an important vehicle for the economy in this region, what does your data suggest about earth changes in the area around the Baltic Sea in terms of the sea itself and the coastline? End of question.
Yes, the area of Scandinavia to a certain extent is isolated from the core of the collapse of the Anglo-American Empire. The maintenance of the Scandinavian currencies, even as they are separate slightly from the euro, is going to hold that amount of damage in abeyance. So let me put it another way. The more intense the bonding between any outlying province and the banking structure of the central empire, the worse it will be for that outlying province, as we saw in the case of the collapse of the currency and the social unrest in the rather staid and laid-back population of Iceland recently. So there is that as a warning. The American and Anglo-American Empire, the what we think of as the central bank and warfare model of human existence, is dying. Whether any of us do anything about it or not, it will die. Its process of death is predetermined by its process of beginning and the fact that we're at that end of dozens and dozens of cycles, which include the cycles that support that level of infrastructure. In addition to that, we have the problems that for that paradigm, the central bank and warfare model, it has run into a whole series of issues relative to the internet and the spread of knowledge about its even mere existence. So it's been pretty much predetermined. The collapse of it is going to be very horrific for the country that I'm in now, and will be less so actually for the Scandinavian countries, including, say, from even perhaps Holland, but certainly Denmark north, all over to Finland and into Russia. The resources that are available for the Scandinavian countries, and actually let's just say the northern part of the planet, and the climatic changes that we're going to undergo are going to bond and juxtapose and create actually a fairly bright future for those areas. Once the domination of this central bank and warfare model crumbles and the inventiveness and the initiative of the populations are let loose. We have to understand that the central bank and warfare model extends to a level of mind control that is truly staggering, where these individuals are attempting to warp history, deny knowledge in huge amounts to everybody on the planet, and keep everything that they can possibly keep hidden only to themselves. Once we see the actual fracturing of the financial structure that gives them power, then some of the other areas of their control will break as well, and we'll see certain areas of the planet become, in our data, it shows certain areas of the planet becoming very much as though productivity has been stepped upon for centuries and it's suddenly let loose, and the areas will extend. In the entire northern region, there is going to be a bond that will extend from Siberia all the way across the planet into Canada and bond all of those peoples and nations together. And they will join with people at the other end of the planet, that is to say in South Africa and South America, and produce some truly amazing things relative to the new electrics. That's actually the hotbed, so to speak, of the new electrics that we see coming out. It appears to be a level of knowledge and understanding, plus a certain level of crystalline components that are in the far north that don't exist in the main temperate zones. And I don't know what those crystalline components are just yet. We don't have any definitive answer on that, as well as the ability of those individuals in that structure to reorganize themselves after the collapse. And that's a big issue. We don't really have a lot of time to devote to that, but the very nature of the people that are living in Scandinavia, in spite of the fact of recent immigration and the alteration of the mindset that brought with it, still maintain a level of interpersonal harmony that will allow them to overcome some of the stress points of the future better than people that are living around the equator and in other parts of the planet. As far as the coastline and stuff goes, again, the data seems to favor north of 40 as being more stable than below 40 degrees of latitude. And the further north you go up into the 60s, the more that stability is assured. So I'm not looking for, it would surprise me to see vast changes of coastline in a negative sense around those areas that are north of 40. There will be some level of sea alteration, But again, because of the nature of the oblate spheroid that is the Earth, much more of the alteration of the sea levels will occur at the equator than will occur at the poles. And in spite of the level of data that we have at the moment, there doesn't appear to be a major crustal shift that is in the near future. It may be beyond 2013, and our data sets just trail off miserably beyond that. But between now and 2013, while there's going to be all kinds of Earth changes and solar activity, we don't have any definitive data set that we can look at that maintains itself over time for the idea of a large crustal shift. End of statement.
Thank you very much. I would like to ask a question that came from a reader who goes into the dating precisely of your data. I think you heard about the discussion about the 21st of December 2012 versus the date proposed by Kalimann, which is the 28th of October 2011. So does your data tell you anything in relation to these two dates, knowing that the 2012 date is sort of the, let's say, mainstream date, and then there is this 28th October 2011 date, which is not widely recognized but being looked at carefully by people like Kalimann and astrologers, and I've also looked at it. Do you have anything about that to say?
We actually have two data sets that we maintain. It's interesting about the two dates. Let's examine the latter date first. December 21, 2012, at 11:11 a.m., not p.m., is the alignment that was deliberately created by Pope Gregory under the auspices or under the direction of the powers that be at that time. They took a German mathematician of some note who assembled a team, and then they used texts that theoretically do not exist. This is to say, many of the Mayan books that were said to have been burned, in fact, were not burned, and they were carefully crated up and taken back to the Vatican as part of the payoff for the expeditions and the slicing of the planet between the Spanish and the Portuguese by the popes of that time. Now, when Pope Gregory had the calendar redone, they went to considerable work. That is to say, a team of 15 mathematicians, led by this particular German mathematician, spent some 5 months in the reconciliation level alone to get the Gregorian calendar to align specifically with the end of the Mayan calendar on these particular numbers. So they did it from a numerological viewpoint. They wanted the 11:11 a.m. because 11 is the number of mastery. It is one number beyond divinity. And the 11:11 combination brings you to 22, which is their number for sainthood or ascension. And then the whole December 12, 2012, if you start looking at the numerological values that are inherent within that, you see that it continually points back to the broken cross or the what's known as the swastika. This swastika has been tainted by the use by Hitler et al., but in fact it's a very meaningful symbol that derives extremely ancient. I mean, even the Jain, who go back millions of years, found that symbol handed to them as opposed to discovering it. And here's what it really means. If you look down on a swastika and the idea of a broken cross, it's both the double cross indicating the four-sided pyramid, or five-sided counting the bottom, but it also, in this particular instance, represents a solar effect. The solar effect can be seen from the sun or from outside the Earth, but we can't really see it from here. But there are these four streams of activity that go from the magnetic field of the Earth up to the sun. And because of the rotation of both the sun and the Earth, these streams are not held as continuous straight lines, but in fact bend and twist. Now, they don't really twist like a spiral in a candy or something. They just twist at this one particular point, and so from an outside view, they form the swastika. So the swastika is actually encoded in the way in which the 2012 date was worked out. It was encoded as a reference to solar activity that they understand will occur at that time. And the thinking at the time from the Gregorian calendar, Pope Gregory et al., relates entirely to these hidden level Mayan books that I believe the Vatican still possesses, which go to great detail, according to references I've read about those things that were theoretically burned. These went to some great detail as to the solar stuff that was going to occur. Now, I actually am of the opinion that Kalaman is much more correct than people would give him credence for, but that nonetheless, the actual end date of the calendar is the 2012 date, the end date of the long count. It may not be as meaningful as Kalaman's date, though, because Kalaman is actually working on a different view of the conjunction of the calendars, and he's discussing the beginning of the end rather than the end of the end, if we want to look at it that way. So his is much more pertinent to us because it is the point at which we would take that step. Now, as I'd referred to earlier, from a 00 class civilization into a class 1 civilization, that will be the opportune moment, that will be the kairos, the quality of time will favor humans doing something magnificent in October of 2011 onward, and that the viewpoint from the powers that be is that their particular point of maximum stress, danger, risk, and opportunity is the 2012 date. End of statement.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Just to switch gears now a bit towards other questions, although we had set and we are having this always in mind right now in this now moment that we cannot measure the unknown with the known. However, we're interested in silver and gold. And so since gold and silver are priced in US dollars at the moment, what is your take on the timing of when these commodities slash currencies, because gold is also currency, are dislocated from the US dollar? And what will be the new reference mechanism, in your opinion, in terms of pricing outside the US itself? So let's say, for instance, in Sweden, we buy gold using Swedish currency, but the price of gold is converted to Swedish krona in relation to the exchange rate of US dollar, and then in relation to the COMEX price per ounce, which is this illusory paper price. So when the US dollar is rejected by all, how will gold and silver be priced? That's the first question. And in conjunction with that comes my own second question, which is simply to ask you if you could elaborate a little bit more on how you see silver performing as opposed to gold. End of question.
Sure. This is it makes a lot of sense, and it's something we've been trying to reconcile here, especially in my discussions with George Ure, because he's a very good economist, but he likes numbers, and of course all of his numbers are dollar-based. So let's take the latter question first. After the disconnect, gold and silver will be valued in two separate different ways. Silver, in the view that we have, will be basically the daily transaction, weekly transaction currency. Gold, on the other hand, will be what you would use to make a life-altering purchase, such as the purchase of property, whereas silver would be used to make purchases or transactions that would relate to daily needs or weekly needs. I'm not saying that we'll use silver per se to purchase fuel, but we certainly won't be using gold. Gold will become so largely precious that we will return to the understanding of gold and silver that they used to have at the beginning of the Roman Empire, or the beginning of the what's known as the seven-state period of India. In that period of time, an ounce of gold was understood to have the ability to purchase ability for a single person to live relatively luxurious. That is to say, in the time of Rome, an ounce of gold would purchase the acquisition of a house for a year and food for a year. Or it might purchase the two slaves for a year and the ability to feed them for a year. Whereas silver would be more of a commodity, and you might use a bunch of silver to buy ampules of wine for a year. And you'd have those much more silver in circulation. And we're going to get to the point actually where there's an extreme level of that, and gold will become hardly circulated at all and only used for major transactions. Now, we saw some of that in the United States back in the previous depression in the 30s, where after the bank holidays in the 30s and the collapse of the bond structures here as we moved into 35, 6, and 7, and that experience of the Depression here, gold took on a different level of understanding than existed for the federal government. Bearing in mind that gold had been, quote, seized by our federal government here, in reality, less than a third was ever handed in, and probably something only closer to 10%, and it had gold coins had, and even gold nuggets, had a back or a black or gray economy value all out of proportion to the, quote, $35 an ounce price set by the government. Now, our government had intended to use gold to get a inflation started again during an incredibly difficult period of deflation. Deflation kills governments. They can always live with inflation, even hyperinflation, but deflation kills governments. And so they're desperately afraid of that. So in our case, the gold was seized in the 30s in the U.S., not for hoarding purposes or anything, but as an attempt to reset its price from the low 20s to the $35 an ounce in order to force a level of inflation. And it was actually far more successful than they'd ever known because gold took on its own level of own life in these back-channel operations such that individuals could go and buy 2,500 acres of land for 4 ounces of gold delivered person to person. And it was only perhaps 10 or 15 years later that that transaction was formalized and recorded in a county deed with a particular price on it because no one wanted to acknowledge that they'd been swapping the gold because the whole thing was illegal. So the timing that we're looking at now in our data shows that over the course of fall, the stresses on the dollar are going to become very acute, and perhaps sometime before the end of December, we may even see the COMEX itself as an institution fail. And we will certainly see stresses upon the currencies that may produce a steep drop in the dollar from its current level in, say, 70 or whatever it is within the basket of currencies. I would not be surprised to see it drop to 60 and then very shortly thereafter take another very large drop down to perhaps 40. And then it may take a long time to go from 40 to 20. And that long time would exist from November of this year until November of 2010. And by the time we reach November of 2010, looking at the data, it seems to suggest that a larger percentage of transactions will be done, even in this country, outside of the dollar system than will be done within the dollar system. And that is true of all currencies. So by 2010, we may see the dollar so totally rejected that, for instance, the Swedish kroner has to, at that point, be backed by gold. Simply to exist as a separate currency, or backed by forests, or a harvest of sea creatures, or something, some physical commodity, calorie kind of thing. And when that occurs, the global revaluing of the few small ounces of gold that exist relative to each and every individual will occur. And so we may actually see a form outside of the United States, and outside of the central bank and warfare model, in those countries that are rebuilding themselves outside of that model, which will include the Scandinavian countries, perhaps Switzerland, certainly what's left of France after it goes through the riots and the disruptions of this coming year. As they rebuild, we may see a period where the government gets honest and starts offering people with gold to purchase the gold with real goods such that the government can have a store of gold to back their currencies. And thus, gold will become more valuable but less in circulation. And it will cause a great alteration in the layout of who is powerful and who is not. And the powers that be, even though they have been in the process of hoarding gold and so forth, the revolutionary wave will separate many of them from these giant hordes of gold and will tend to redistribute it. However, there's 6.5 billion people on the planet. Our data expects that over 1 billion will die in the next few years, but nonetheless, that still leaves approximately 5 billion people on the planet and only 4 billion ounces of gold ever removed from the ground and approximately half of those out of circulation. So gold will take on a particularly acute function in our global society as a storehouse representing the wealth of calories. Convoluted answer, I know, but that's the best we can do. I suspect most of it will really kick off for people outside the U.S. after November 4th of this year. End of statement.
Thank you, Cliff. I'm completely with it. Most of it, all of us here, we understand you very well, and I know from astrology from my comparisons to what happened before that this makes sense. And now, going to this thing about the silver, because you had said that you would see via linguistics that silver could be so far more valuable compared to gold than gold is now, or than silver is now, meaning that the ratio between silver and gold will also change. Can you go into this a little bit more?
Yeah, we have a historical precedent for silver-gold relationships in almost all social orders that archaeologists have been able to get at. So, for instance, we know at the beginning of the Roman Empire that silver and gold occupied a 1 ounce of gold could buy you 4 ounces of silver when things started rolling. As the empire expanded and silver became a little bit more plentiful, it started going up to 1 to 8, eventually reached 1 to 15, where it hovered for a number of centuries, and then through debasement went to a 1 to 30. We know, for instance, at the moment that priced in dollars, using the illusionary paper ETFs and everything, there's approximately a 1 to 70 relationship between gold and silver, and that the silver is maligned, so to speak, that actual physical stores of the silver become more valuable as we discover how little silver there is. Now, this is a curious part of our data, because gold, even though it has some industrial applications and is somewhat used up in the process of making computers and even cell phones, silver, on the other hand, has a whole lot of industrial applications. Much of it is actually consumed and in a non-recoverable form. But our data seems to show that there is a new future for silver, and that part of that will be associated with some of the discoveries that come out in November, December, relative to the new electrics. It would appear that silver will become a vital material to be used in the restraining, if you will, of energy for the new electrics. So it may be that there is some capacity for silver to store huge amounts of electricity in a silver atom that then could be stored in copper or any other form of atom outside of the crystals. Now, I bring that up because we see that after November of 2010, there's another major change for silver, and it drops from this highly prized area, and it is replaced industrially by the discovery or the perfection of a process where we get hold of this crystalline material that will come from the far north, be melded to an understanding that will arise out of South Africa and South America, and we'll be able to use these crystals to store energy at huge levels in minute quantities, and thereafter silver will simply become a currency. But between now and then, we will probably actually see some pressure on the price of silver based on its ability to facilitate electrical stuff. So it may become more prized as this particular industrial material than as a storehouse of wealth, even though it will occupy both at the same time. And this is part of the process whereby this 1 to 70 relationship will be severed and will probably at one point drop down to, if not 1 to 1, then at least 1 to 3. But that is only brief, and it'll be temporary, and it'll be in the midst of the dollar chaos. So attempting to time that kind of thing doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Plus, anybody that's attempting to do that kind of timing is still trapped in the idea that they can, quote, gather wealth just by being really smart that way. And we have to start thinking differently. End of statement.
Got it. Okay, got it. That was well said. We're smiling here. Now on to new set of three questions coming from Japan from my friend Ruben, who is doing the video about my other work. He asked you the following three questions. So I read you the first. It is my understanding that the true nature of the changes is unpredictable and that some geographical locations seem more vulnerable than others. I see, as does Lady No Eyes or Edgar Cayce and any others, that the Japanese archipelago will be strongly affected, but at the same time much better prepared internally to these coming changes. How will countries like Japan and Bolivia, Nepal fare during this transformative period? End of first question.
I'm of the opinion that the hang on a second, let me see what the dog's doing.
Sophie, it's okay, sweetie.
No.
No, guys.
They're upset about something, but as long as they're barking, it's not really anything more than their own figments of their imagination. Hang on just a second.
Hey! Quiet.
Anyway, Japan is a particular subject of some concern to me because I have ties to it through the Aikido, and its situation is not good. It sits right on a very particular level of ridges within the Ring of Fire. If it is lucky, it won't sink any further than it really already has. We have to understand that much of Japan is already underwater. The actual country may be five or six times what is currently occupied based on the undersea monuments. So leaving Japan aside for a second, let's look at the elevated regions. Nepal and Bolivia, I don't expect to see much in the way of change at all. Those areas have gone through this in a previous occurrence. And so, for instance, we know that the archaeology around Lake Titicaca in the Altiplano suggests that it was a seaport that was raised up from a sea level to about 11,000 feet over the course of approximately 7 days with much loss of structure and life. Bolivia came along to a lesser extent during that period of time. Those areas, given the fact that any continent can simply collapse, any continent is basically just floating on top of it's a bunch of dirt that's accumulated on top of some very large rocks. These very large rocks are the crustal plates, but they're just floating, so to speak, and they're not solid. They're not interconnected. They can break up and sink at any given time based on what's going on. Our data suggests that we're going to go through some fairly larger changes, the level of which is entirely unknowable, and we only have little tiny hints. Those little hints we get seem to suggest that there will be areas that will have another lifting event. And we may indeed see such strangeness as the west coast of the U.S. rising up another Andean-style altiplano that makes the Rocky Mountains look small. During that period of time, there is some suggestion that in the last time this occurred, a very large landmass sank. That landmass was south of India in the Great Southern Ocean, and it apparently just sank below several thousand feet of water during this last giant upheaval. Now, let's stop for a second and look at some of the other data that seems to suggest that this time through the changes will be less horrific from a human viewpoint than previous times. So we may indeed get giant floods, but the data so far seems to suggest that the floods will not be the type that will scrub whole continents clean. We also have another issue relative to Japan and coastlines in particular, and that is that the overall, in spite of the water being water levels rising globally with the melt and so on, there seems to be both evidence and manifesting reality, as well as evidence or suggestions within our data, that almost all the coastlines are going to go through at least some level of a rising event. The only way I can reconcile this is to accept the idea of a plasma model for the planet. And that is to say that the model is that there's no molten core in the middle of the Earth, because a molten core of iron cannot hold magnetism and cannot generate magnetism no matter how much it spins. And so the only molten anything that could generate the level of magnetic field we have now would be a giant plasma reaction, which makes sense because matter has to come from somewhere. The E equals MC squared equation is actually a circular reference. As energy is created in universe, it also has to create matter, otherwise the universe would be manifestly completely 100% filled with energy. And we know that's not the case, that energy comes into existence, things happen in the material world, and matter is shoved around, including created. And so if that's the case, then Japan may fare better than we would expect otherwise, simply because the whole of the Earth is expanding and is going to grow a little bit larger. And because it's going to grow a little bit larger, we're going to have these unsettling Earth changes, and perhaps even have some sinking areas as the skin of the orange of the Earth, so to speak, grows, pulls apart to accommodate the larger amount of matter in the middle of it. But that'll also drain some of the ocean levels. So, for instance, our stuff on the coasts could be taken to be interpreted either way, that there are going to be tidal influences that cause humans problems, but those tidal influences could be that the tides recede, and thus all of our ports may become inland bases of some 2 or 3 or 4 miles, depending on how much actual recession occurs. Does that make sense?
Yes. Can I give you first...